Ooh, there I am. All right, you ready? Come on back. What do the following have in common? Ancient civilizations, epic battles, otherworldly visions, future predictions, Hanukkah, and news from Friday about U.S. missile strikes in Syria in retaliation to chemical warfare against their citizens. Daniel chapter 8! Here's how. Over and over again throughout the book of Daniel, whether it's eating vegetables instead of the king's table, or the fiery furnace, strange dreams that get interpreted, lions, and now visions, there's one predominant theme. God is king everywhere and for all time. And I think especially in the book of Daniel, I love the fact that this theme comes out in this book and where it comes out. It's not like while the Jews are in power at, you know, the height of either King David or King Solomon. It's in exile. It's in Babylon. It's under the oppression of foreign kings and rulers that this theme is so important for God's people and also for us. God is king. He dictates the course of history. Up until this point, chapters 1 through 7, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. It's the common language of the time. Daniel means it to be an open letter. Dear world, God reigns. And here's some glimpses into that. But we switch now in chapter 8 through to chapter 12. It switches to Hebrew. Daniel is now shifting gears. And this is meant primarily to be a private letter to the people of God, the Jews, written in their native language, in Hebrew, warning them that really tough times are coming, but be encouraged because God is still king, and he will triumph. So for some context, this happens, this vision we learn in chapter 1 is the third year of King Belshazzar's reign. Sorry, verse 1. So from last Sunday to this Sunday, we've jumped forward in the future 2 years. So it's still King Belshazzar, but you're now into his third reign. In terms of events in the book of Daniel, you'll remember King Nebuchadnezzar, so the vision of the statue, the fiery furnace, the vision of the tree that gets cut down, he's died. And King Belshazzar is now in power. Chapter 4, you have King Nebuchadnezzar, sudden switch in chapter 5 to Belshazzar with, of course, the feast that he throws. Him and his nobles mock God by drinking out of these sacred vessels of the temple, the writing of the hand on the wall. God seals his doom. That night he dies and the Persian Empire takes over. That hasn't happened yet, but it's coming, and it's coming real soon. So you're right kind of after chapter 4, beginning of chapter 5 in terms of the events of the book of Daniel. And Daniel himself seems to have fallen out of favor a little bit with the court. He's, you know, with Nebuchadnezzar, he was held in very high esteem. He's likely now sort of relegated to some administrative role. He's still respected, but he's not as prominent, or so we can tell, during the reign of King Belshazzar. In chapter 8, verse 1 and 2, have chapter 8 open, because what's fun about chapter 8, I know Cam last week told me that I get the hard job of chapter 8. I think his was way harder because all these weird beasts that we don't really know what they are and there's a lot of opinions as to what they can be, I actually really have the easy job. The first 14 verses are Daniel's vision and 15 to 27 is the interpretation. We're told what these are. We don't have to guess. So I'm excited about that. Throughout Daniel, we see God revealing future events, a dream that Nebuchadnezzar has with the different kingdoms that are coming after him and God's kingdom that would be established. Chapter 7, these beasts that represent different kingdoms. And now in chapter 8, we have two animals that represent kingdoms. God is showing what's going to happen. So have chapter 8 open. I'm going to do a bit of jumping around between the vision in the first part and the interpretation in the second part. So just track with me here. Daniel writes, "In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulal Canal." Daniel is likely in Babylon, but he's having this vision in the citadel of Susa, about 250 kilometers east in the heart of Persia, which is an empire that is growing and has become a threat to Babylon. In this vision, he looks up and sees a ram with two horns standing beside the canal. The horns were long, one of the horns longer than the other, but grew up later. "I watched the ram as it charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against it. None could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased, and it became very great." What's the deal with horns in Daniel? There's two horns, then there's one horn that breaks into four horns that another horn grows out of. At least as far as Daniel's concerned, every time you see the word horn, that's a specific person or kingdom, but usually a specific person, all right? So we're told exactly who this ram is. Jump to verse 20. "The two-horned ram you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia." Media was sort of the original power that came and ends up taking over Babylon. And Persia, there's sort of this cooperation between the two, but Persia ends up growing and being more dominant. Although they come on the scene later, they end up being more dominant, which is why you have two horns, but the bigger one comes up later. So far, so good? This ram charges. Do you guys have my map up there? There you go. This is the Persian Empire, which sort of west or east of Susa was already existing, and they end up coming in west towards Greece, north towards the Caspian Sea, and south towards Egypt. And by the time this is finished, you've got this vast empire that spans a chunk of Asia, a bit of Africa, and starting to go into Europe. So this is the direction of the ram charging from the east west. In verse 5, as I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes, biblical vindication for the existence of the unicorn. I've totally lost my place. So distracted by the unicorn. "Came from the west this time, from the west towards the east. And it crossed the whole earth without touching the ground." This image of speed, incredible speed with which the goat comes. "It came at the two-horned ram, which I had seen standing beside the canal, and charged at it in great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and no one could rescue it from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up from the four winds of heaven." Well, we are told in verse 21 that the shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between its eyes is the first king. Most historians would agree that this very likely refers to Alexander the Great, who comes from Macedonia and it takes over a bunch of Greece and invades the Persian Empire, and ends up in this incredible conquest. He was in his 20s when he started this. And in sort of collaboration with the Bible's vision of this being an immensely speedy animal, he conquers all of this territory up and into India and touching the border of China, including Egypt, in less than 10 years. It's incredible. The Roman Empire, at the height of its power, was not this big. It's an incredible amount of territory that he conquers decisively. About 333, he goes and attacks Darius III, who's the king of Persia, who has an incredibly stronger force. Alexander maybe has 30,000 soldiers. Darius has hundreds of thousands, like some have suggested up to 800,000. He decisively defeats them in two battles. So you have the conquest of this goat coming from the west out towards the east. "At the height of its power, the horn breaks off." Alexander the Great, after he had just finished this conquest, died at 32 years old in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon, ironically, the very place that Daniel's probably writing this very vision. It's replaced, we read, by four horns that grow up out of it to the four corners of the earth. And again, a lot of historians have said this, after Alexander died, there was no succession plan. There's a bit of civil war for 40 years as the generals sort of fight this out. But eventually, four come to the top and they split up the kingdom into the various parts. You've got this. And I'm going to totally butcher these names. Cassander takes over sort of Greece and its region. Lysimachus is Asia Minor, which is Turkey, that green spot in the middle. Seleucus, Syria, Israel, Iran, that's kind of the orange Asian part. And then Ptolemy is Egypt. Out of these, one of these four horns, out of one of these kingdoms, another small horn grows, we read in verse 9, which started small but grew in the south into the east and towards the beautiful land. Israel had the misfortune of bordering two of these empires. The kind of the purple arm that comes up, that's roughly where Jerusalem is. This border shifted back and forth a lot, and as the two sort of areas conflicted and battled for territory, and they suffered quite a bit through this. And one of these horns likely refers the small horn to Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, who comes from Seleucus, this orange empire. And what we read of him is that this horn started small, grows in power, it reached the host of the heavens and threw some of the starry host to the earth, a reference to God's holy people, some of the Jews. Trampled on them, set itself up as a great commander of the army of the Lord, it took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of the rebellion of the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice was given over to it, he prospered in everything he did, and truth was thrown to the ground. We also see in verse 23, he was a fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue who will arise. Antiochus was not the legitimate successor to Seleucus. Through some politics, through some betrayal, and a whole bunch of sneakiness, he gained power and kept it, was not the most reliable guy, and this is likely a hint to this master of intrigue as the vision describes him. He grows towards the beautiful land, towards Jerusalem, where the people of God are, where the Jews are. And one of the things we learn from history about Antiochus is that he takes this name, Epiphanes, means God manifest. He is the incarnation of God, quite the title to give yourself. And he could not tolerate intolerance. It drove him crazy that the Jews had one God and one way to worship. And in the culture of the Greeks who had many gods and were wanting very much the rest of the world because that was the right way to go, tolerance, there was some serious conflict between him and the Jews who had exclusivity of faith. He did horrible things to them. And now about 170 BC, there was a period of 3 days in which he destroyed 80,000 men, women, and children. He made it a capital of punishment. If you read the law of Moses, if you followed the law or observed the Sabbath, he stopped all worship in the temple and sacrifices, and to make matters worse, set up his own altar in God's temple to Zeus and sacrificed a pig on it, an unclean animal, which would have been the ultimate insult to the Jews and to their God, which is referred to here as the abomination that causes desolation. This, by the way, occurred on the 25th of Kislev, corresponding to our December 25th, and brings us to Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the Jews were so outraged by this that the high priest and his sons, led by Judas Maccabeus, waged this kind of terrorist-style warfare against the Greeks and were actually able to drive them out and spent a period of 8 days cleansing and rededicating the temple. One of the legends says that they found only enough oil that was not defiled to light the holy lamp for a single day, which is a problem because it can take at least 8 days to press the proper oil and go, you know, do it properly. But miraculously, this single day supply of oil burned the whole time, which is why the Jews have their menorah with 8 lamps on it and they light them during the different days. Hanukkah means dedication, and it refers to this event in history. Verse 14, he said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. Some of the commentators have said that's just over 6 years, and that refers to the time between Antiochus came to power to the time that the altar was reconsecrated, the temple was rededicated. Others have said, no, that's evenings and mornings. You have to divide it by 2, 1150, which is the amount of time between which the altar was defiled and to when it was rededicated. Do you want to know what I think? Who cares? I don't think Daniel is too concerned about predicting exactly what the day was or which it referred to. The point that Daniel wants us to see very, very, very clearly here is that as horrible as things seem, as evil and as blasphemous as the world gone mad looks like, God has set the exact amount of days which it will prosper, and not a single day more. God is in control. God is king, not the forces of evil or darkness. So, I got this far in my prep, and I had a lot of fun because I love history. And I had to stop and go, that's really interesting, but so what? Daniel's not interested in predicting the future. It's not like there's some cosmic gamble going on that we're trying to figure out if he's right or not. Or pat ourselves on the back because the Bible's proved true because these events worked out. That's not the point Daniel is trying to make for us. Daniel wants us to see history differently. There is the overarching theme of the various kingdoms of the world that we see in Daniel. But throughout the book of Daniel, we get glimpses of the kingdom of God. And Daniel wants us to see the events of the world, of worldly kingdoms, through the lens of the kingdom of God. There's two stories happening here, not one. And the kingdom of the world that you see that's most obvious, seems most chaotic, is not even the most important one. See differently. So, let's do a bit of compare and contrast of these different kingdoms as Daniel gives them to us. You've got the Babylonian Empire, which is just about to end with Persia coming in. You have Persians destroyed by the Greeks who come in, the shaggy goat with the single horn that comes in. And then very shortly after Aristarchus dies in 165-ish, the Romans are in power. So you have this incredible shift of political power in like 200 or so years. And so I think one of the very first things we see and learn about the kingdoms of the world in Daniel is that they're temporary. They don't last all that long, although it might seem long in the moment. They rise and they fall. One of the things we learned about God's kingdom, and it's not, there's hints of it in chapter 8, but you need to go back to chapter 2:44. The vision that Nebuchadnezzar has of the statue and the rock cut that's not by human hands, that smashes it, that ends all of them, and grows to reign forever over the whole earth. God's kingdom does not rise and fall. His kingdom is eternal. It is forever. It just rises. And so you have sort of these two parallel kingdoms and glimpses versus the other. Then you just see some of the imagery in this chapter 8 is astounding, right? Look at, I watched verse 4. As the ram charged from the west, no animal could stand against it. No one could rescue from its power. Or verse 7, it attacked the ram furiously, striking and shattering its horns, knocked to the ground, trampled, no one could rescue it. Verse 10 and 11, it sets itself up as the commander of the army of the Lord takes away the daily sacrifice, which is thrown down. The sacrifice is given over to it. It prospered in what it did. Truth was thrown to the ground. These are very violent pictures and images were given. And as much as the kingdoms of the world are temporary and God's is eternal, the kingdoms of the world are destructive. And sometimes, as we read in Daniel 8, they cause devastation and suffering, sometimes especially for God's people. But what we had touched on in verse 14, the 2,300 evenings and mornings at which point the temple will be reconsecrated, God has the final say, and he limits the period of time of destruction or destructiveness. God's kingdom is restorative. He sets the time on evil. He brings about healing and restoration. And, you know, there's even a glimpse we get through the conquest of Greece throughout the known world that we see God using history. In the wake and the wreckage of the Greek army as it comes through all of Asia and into India and parts of Africa and Egypt, what happens is Greek culture spreads. There's this explosion of learning in Greek culture at the moment. It sets the foundations for science, for mathematics, for astrology. The calculation for pi is invented at this time. The exact axis of the earth and the alignment of the planets. Like, you have this explosion and renaissance of learning and of openness to new ideas, and these set the stage for the democratic systems of government in the ages to come. And Greece is really looked at as a very cool country. In similar ways, I would think, to how the United States is perceived in a lot of the world. The, you know, kind of Western culture is sought after and imitated and replicated. And as a result, not only because Greeks had conquered this area, but also the coolness of Greek culture, the Greek language becomes the worldwide language. Everybody speaks Greek. And again, in the same way that English is kind of like the international trade language for business and for education and whatever today, this has never happened in history until this point in time. And within just over 100 years, Jesus is born. And that God uses the destructive path of the Greek army to pave the way for the spreading of the gospel of peace. God's kingdom is restorative. And he uses history for his kingdom in glory. Verse 25, another glimpse as to what's happening with the kingdoms of the world. He will cause deceit to prosper, will consider himself superior, and when others feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes, referring to God himself. The kingdoms of the world are defiant. You see this a little bit with Nebuchadnezzar. He goes on his balcony one day. Is this not the great Babylon that I have made for my glory? You certainly see it in King Belshazzar, who when he gets out the goblets of the temple and drinks out of them, he's not just drinking out of them because they're pretty gold cups. He is making a statement that I am king, not Yahweh. Or Antiochus, who goes and, first of all, calls himself God incarnate, and then sets up an altar to Zeus in the temple of God.